Welcome, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show. I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. So we are in this deep season. We continue to go in and down to the underworld in order to gather our woof, that we may be ever more effective players on the team of creation. Yes. So we continue to honor the dead. Our great ally, Vine Deloria, great Native American activist, has gone backstage. And we honor him and dedicate this show to him, and more than perfectly to delve into the underworld of mycelium with our onstage guest, Paul Stamets, whom I'll be bringing in some moments. But first, we remember the New Orleans Voodoo Tarot says, the ancestors are those dead whom we take as having directly influenced our becoming. We go, there's great benefit in honoring the underworld, just as there's great danger in ignoring the underworld and its voices. We take the underworld mythologically and also our soil, all of that. The New Orleans Voodoo says, Loa, the great spirits, once lived and walked the earth as women and men, and they can now be claimed as ancestors. We share a symbiotic relationship. As the dead fare, so we fare. And we might also say, as the underworld and the mycelia and the soil fare, so do we fare. If we reach to the heights, we do so upon their shoulders, the dead and the underworld, literally, the womb and the tomb, so praising the dead. So both our allied medicine men, our great ally Paul Stamets, and but before introducing him, let us honor Vine Deloria. Both names, sort of Vine and Stamets, related plants. We remember John Seed, head of Rainforest Action Network, Destiny in the Name, was asked, you know, how do you take heart? How do you not get so discouraged? And he said, if I thought of myself as just human, I would be completely forlorn. But I view myself as an agent of whatever I love. I am the rainforest's human form walking around in collaborative cahoots with it. And we go, may it be so as well. So briefly also, our astrology of now is, it's very busy in our lives, in the world, in the underworld, in the soil, and in the planets. We had a beautiful full moon Monday night, which was extraordinary. Moon in Taurus, exalted kinship with the earth, right next to Mars. Mars now, heroism is in Taurus. It is retrograde, return to earth energies, return to indigenous understanding of collaboration. Mercury's retrograde, so it says, let us regain our voice. Our voice, again, you'll find more than perfectly this hour, too. Mercury retrograde in Sagittarius, finding reflective, knowledgeable, eclectic, multidisciplined, scientific voice for Mars in Taurus, the medicine man, and the whole theme of reverent cooperation. And Uranus, principle of trickster and revelation, is forward. So Mercury retrograde says, reflect, let's gather in council now, because the tide is shifting. Revelation, ingenuity, trickster goes forward. Saturn stationing now, retrograde November 22nd in Leo. And it says, Leo, kingdom. Let's take the G out of kingdom. And we say it is all kingdoms, absolutely. So Vine Deloria was an extraordinary great ally in many ways. He wrote, of course, Custer Died for Your Sins. He was a unique voice, grouchy and garrulous, as one of his tributes, tossing out one-liners while excoriating Anglo hypocrisies and urging Indians to get up and stand up. And I add in here, too, but he didn't let anybody off the hook. He's like, white people, don't tiptoe around Native Americans, because it's not good for them either. Just, oh, everybody. All right. Earlier this year, he was honored here in Washington, D.C. at the National Press Club and awarded the American Indian Visionary Award. I was there for that. Thank wonderfulness. And then at different talks, he'd say, I'd like the freedom to say harsh things to people in the audience. And he used to do that, too. At one point, he readily admitted with considerable relish, the worst guy you can have speak because I've got nothing to lose. I don't care who I insult. And, he was outside after a speech and the writer says, there he was, soft-spoken and thoughtful, fretting about the future of Native American youth, fretting about the future of this planet. He was charming, slightly terrifying, and completely unforgettable, and that's absolutely true. He says, the tribal religions are more relevant to issues confronting mankind today than traditional Christian concepts, he asserted in his book, God is Red. He asserts that Christianity justifies imperialism, rootlessness, environmental destruction, and maintains that America's survival depends on a theological revolution. And again, he loved science too, theological scientific revolution. So at any one moment, says an ally, he had a book that was just coming out, a book he was writing, a book being edited, a book he was just getting started on, Plus, he responded to all his correspondence sometimes the same day. I don't know how he did it. At the time of his death, he had just finished two books, one about the powers of Native American medicine men, the other about pioneering Swiss psychiatrist Carl Jung and the Sioux. And when he wasn't writing, he loved watching classic movie westerns on TV, and that would have been a treat to watch those with him. On my way here, I was shaking out his books, and a letter from him fell out. I go, oh, letters from the dead. He said many wonderful things, but he said he's working, this was years ago, on a book called The Structure of Human Personality. This is from his letter to me, which would take the medicine man as the model and demonstrate that it is the ability to glimpse into the other worlds, tempered with the capability of living constructively in this one, that constitutes the fully developed human personality. So we go, he said, I finished the second volume, almost had a contract, goes on, but then he says, Sioux medicine men do some remarkable things, taken for granted in our communities, but abstracted and placed along philosophical systems. They give great insight into solving all kinds of world problems. The kinship system, with all of its requirements, provides a set of incredible concepts to use in analyzing social conditions. So I am constantly thrown off center by believing I can write about these things clearly. You are, of course, he wrote to me, not obligated to read any of these books I'm sending you, but they're merely a way of expressing gratitude for sending me the tapes of that sexy voice of yours, which sparks pleasant memories of my reckless youth. He was an Aries, bless his heart. But if you get an attack of insomnia, they're a pleasant way to break it and go right back to sleep. He said, I'm diving into manuscripts. He said, you are some kind of healer, though, as I have felt qualitatively better physically since talking with you and finding my working schedule miraculously cleared from some heavy burdens so I can do what I really want to do. And he says, I will let chance take over, direct our future contacts. That way we will force the cosmos to take the initiative and devise its own way of getting us in the same place at the same time, revealing, I trust, what it is we should do together. He was going to come on this radio show. For many years, I ran around the national scene trying to make reforms and nearly wore myself out. Then I began to let the cosmos take charge and discovered that if you're supposed to be somewhere with particular people, it will all be arranged. In the interim, you have your work to do. Follow your path. The old Maka spiritual leaders in Washington State would sit on a part of the beach and allow things to come to them, and they were never disappointed. I will therefore follow the only path I know, and you will be waiting somewhere down the road. Ha! So, we certainly dedicate this show to great Vine Deloria. And more than perfectly, we have our great onstage, extremely living, vital ally, Paul Stamets, who's been devoted for 30 years of his life, at least, to mycelia. His latest book is Mycelium Running, How Mushrooms Can Help Save the World. I have quoted his work ever since I first heard about it for years because it is so crucial. I talk about it on airplanes with people next to me, everywhere. We will dive into it certainly as well. And his website is fungi.com. So he's written over, six books, and maybe this is the seventh, some used as textbooks around the world by the gourmet and medicinal mushroom industry. But this book, I say with complete sincerity, Mycelium Running, I give it 5 stars. I'm doing all my Christmas shopping here. It is crucial for really anyone. It is a great book to have. I'm doing all my Christmas shopping and solstice shopping at fungi.com as well. So welcome, Paul Stamets.
Well, thank you, Carolyn. That was quite an introduction.
Yeah. Well, Vine Deloria would have really liked the work that you were doing, absolutely, and said, let's go back to these earth-based, you know, deep, reverent ways and backed up with science, and let's go. So the medicine man, you said earlier too, you know, earth mysticism, because I praised your book, which is so beautifully written. I don't say this about all the authors on the show. It is so beautifully written, and you said, yeah, earth mysticism, you know, giving a smart voice to what we all know and hope to be true, and informing people in lucid, irrefutable language. So, medicine man, shall we dive in there?
Well, sure. This seems quite appropriate. It wasn't long ago that shamans and doctors were one and the same, and then there was a big division as science progressed, and it really came into focus when I wrote an article for Herbalgram on novel antivirals for mushrooms, and one of the peer reviewers, I didn't know it at the time, it was Nancy Turner, who was a well-known ethnobotanist, and she correctly pointed out when I wrote in this article prior to being printed that there was a mushroom that was used against tuberculosis. It was back in Dioscorides' time. It was called agarikon, and back then we called it consumption. And she pointed out very correctly, well, back in Dioscorides' time, they did not know that tuberculosis was caused by a microbe. It was just a symptom. And that really was an interesting comment she made, and it drove me to thinking, because irrespective of whether you're a shaman or a doctor, both hold in common of treating disease as being caused by spirits in the unseen world. A doctor will call it a microbe, a shaman will call it a spirit. But indeed, I think microbes have spirits, and so I think we're going full circle. And the great lesson that Native Americans have brought forward and through all the chaos and cacophony of the media is this concept of seven generations. And I think it's something that we should codify into our culture as being one of the primary guiding principles of how we behave on this planet today. This consumerism and this appetite that we have to get everything we can in our lifetime in disregard for future generation is really antithetical to our own existence. We are here today because we're evolutionary success of lots of symbiotic relationships of organisms that have come together to bring us here, and also we've had these cultural support systems of our families and people thinking downstream generations. And I think that we are so busy these days that we don't really look towards the future, and all the great scientists in the world are unified that we are approaching or undergoing a global catastrophe, an ecological form of suicide that we need to wake up and pay attention.
Yeah, and your book is so lucid in its lead-in in articulating that, again, in irresistibly eloquent, just irrefutable language, saying, oh, and I for years have liked saying, you know, let natural facts be social strategy metaphors, because the mycelium, maybe you guide us into meeting them, to, you know, you say they are the original internet, you know, and that we're really evolving the internet as a kind of biomimicry to help us share information, to adopt, to become more reverent, yeah?
Well, I would call it micromimicry, but yes.
Okay, micromimicry, that's good.
Yeah, most people may not realize that we walk upon these living sentient membranes of these cells that are forming chains, and these are fungal cellular networks. The largest organism in the world is a mycelial mat in eastern Oregon. It's over 2,200 acres in size, over 2,400 years old. It's actually climaxed and killed the forest at least six times over, and this mother mycelium is a governing influence in building soil. 10,000 years ago, when the ice age receded and the glaciers retreated, it left this in the soil basically flushed into the ocean. And these gravel bars remained, but they were not very life-supporting. But lenses of soil did survive. Plant communities then began to thrive. They grew up. They climaxed. The saprophytic fungi or the parasitic fungi killed the plants, and the saprophytic fungi broke them down, and the soil became a little thicker. The lens became a little larger. And as these lenses increased, both in size and depth, then biodiversity increased because the soil could support more diverse populations. But as these fungal networks, see, that form these micro cavities on a microscopic level that become little cocoons of warm, fuzzy growths of mycelium that are like pillows that these giant, these diverse microbial communities then begin to thrive within. And all soil comes from the activity of these fungal networks breaking down plant and animal tissue. I just found a really interesting article. It just came out this past week. But before I talk about it, you know, 465 million years ago, we shared a common ancestry with fungi.
I love that.
And basically, we are mushroom people. and then as fungi diversified and basically hit the beach and went overland, as we went overland, then we had to protect moisture loss from ourselves, and then we encircled nutrients and produced gastric juices and enzymes and acids to digest the food from within. The mycelial networks went underground, and they didn't lose their moisture as readily. They're not exposed to the air for the most part. And as a result, they retain their single cellular structure. In terms of having a single cell wall, these chains are huge. And there's in a single cubic inch of soil, there can be more than 8 miles of these cells in a single cubic inch. They're everywhere. Anyone's not seen it, just go outside and just knock over a log or a stick, and you'll see mycelium. Actually, this time of year, the mycelium reaches up to the surface, and you can see these white, sort of like snow foams that are forming all over the landscapes. And this is the mycelium reaching up because the moisture is so high. The article that I just found, and I give credit to actually a person in Berkeley who sent it to me, is in the Journal of Eukaryotic Microbial Research, and it's volume 52, number 5, 2005, and a group of 22 eukaryologists. Now, these are eukaryotic biologists, scientists, and eukaryotes are basically organisms that have a nucleus and a membrane, and our DNA is inside that. That's us. And they have found, and they have now proposed, and there's 22 co-authors on this paper, that indeed fungi and animalia, us, are in one kingdom.
Ah.
And so we are now in the same kingdom of as fungi, and I give them an A-plus for the logic and the science. I give them an F for the new name. I like animalia. It was a good name. So the new name is Opisthoconta.
Oh, no.
I know. Why do they have the word, they put the word piss in it? I don't know, but it's going to be the butt of a lot of jokes, I'm afraid. But this is the new macro kingdom that encompasses fungi and animals. And many physicians know, and unfortunately particularly AIDS patients know, that if you get a bacterial infection, there's lots of good fungal-based antibiotics. But if you get a fungal infection, there's very few antibiotics that are out there that don't harm you also as the host, because we are so much more closely related to fungi than we are to bacteria, and so the antifungal drugs tend to hurt us as well. So this is really interesting as evolution marches forward and we look backwards, then we can see these commonalities and they give us tremendous strength and wisdom. I find this whole argument about intelligent design to be so funny on so many levels, because my mother is a charismatic Christian. She's very conservative. I grew up in that sort of environment. I'm sort of not in that camp, but I'm really experienced with that camp. But to me, there's a unifying discussion that one could have, and basically simply this. I think evolution is nature's intelligent design.
Right.
I mean, this is the whole game here. And they're saying that it can't be this, it can't be without God's influence because it's so complex. Well, no, I won't say it, blank Sherlock, but you know, yes, this is what nature is all about. We have pulsed through, forward through the theater of experimentation, and natural selection does work, folks. You know, if you run faster, you get there first, and if there's food there, you get the food, and the other people don't. So faster runners tend to get more food. I mean, across the board, you know, I don't think there's anybody who would disagree that natural selection is operating.
Although I just have to interject and say, I love the saying, it says it's the early bird that gets the worm, but it's the second rat that gets the cheese. just for the fun. Just there's langer is built in too. But
well, I mean, there's all sorts of unique strategy that nature has employed, and these diverse strategies, I think, show that there's not just one game. You have to have multiple alternative strategies should one or one fail. So backup of those organisms that have backup strategies sort of rule and march forward. And I've got superb examples of that specifically with some of the research and that I've done with mycopesticides and developing environmentally benign ways of controlling insects. But let me go back to the origins of sort of life on this planet.
Let's do that. But also just the intelligent design conversation I think is so crucial, because to jump into it, and maybe you with your mother as well, is we can also say, well, intelligent design, then nature is God's scripture, and why would you mess with that? I mean, it does seem the unifying conversation, as you suggest, is I think an important one, you know. And then anyway,
well, there's two assumptions that I think we all can agree upon, no matter if you think about the concept of God, it is our minds are inadequate of comprehending the enormity of the concept. That's a given, because if God is who some people are postulating, then it's such a magnificent, large idea that we can't wrap our brains around it. Two, nature's intelligent. Nature's intelligent, and evolution is nature's intelligent design because we're intelligent. And we are born from nature. And so the mother that gives us birth has given us our intelligence. And so I believe nature is intelligence. I believe microbes have consciousness. I
yes.
believe that they, all these organisms on this planet are intelligent. I've got three dogs. They have emotions. They're happy. They get sad. They get excited. They're obviously intelligent, you know. But how we cryptically define the word intelligence makes us look, frankly, biologically provincial. We need to expand that concept enormously. So as we march forward on this evolutionary path, and I do believe that we'll find fungal-like organisms throughout the universe. My father, who was a very conservative scientist, you know, he got real excited one day because he was a mathematician and a nuclear engineer, and he started punching a calculator, and he taught in colleges and certified them for the American Society of Mechanical Engineers and later on in his life. And he got real excited when he started reading Carl Sagan. And he goes, "Paul, I can prove to you there's at least 100 planets out there that have life." You know, and I was going, "Whoa, this is very interesting." My dad mathematically was convinced with all the coefficient variables where he, you know, said, "Well, if this assumption's off by 6 orders of magnitude, then, therefore," and he multiplied everything out, and he still came out with more than 100 planets. And I think that matter begets life. Life first forms as single-celled organisms, quickly chains form, communities obviously can share resources, they can protect each other, alliances form, species then begin collaboration on intricate levels, in some cases whether they want to or not, just by sheer evolutionary pressure, you know, they are selected out to be favorable. And then as these cellular networks form, you know, chains and branches in the chains prevent any one locus from having a critical point that the organism can be destroyed. And so the mycelial nets, you can't go up to a web of mycelium and shoot it with a shotgun. It will say thank you. And then it will split and grow and fork, just like when you trim an apple tree. Then branches form behind the cut. And same is true with mushroom mycelium. And so then as the mycelium marched forward, and then speciation began on this planet, and then we marched forward through time, and we have plants and animals and bacteria and protozoa and all these other things that are happening. And then 250 million years ago, there was a great cataclysmic event. An asteroid came out of the sky and slammed into the Earth. Most people believe that. Most scientists do. And then something remarkable happened, not only from the impact, but the residue, and that the sky is darkened with dust, and the Earth was shrouded in darkness. And so all these photosynthesizing plants, and there was 90% of the species became extinct. There was no sunlight. And so those plants, because they didn't have light, died, but those that had made a marriage with fungi, who could then feed them sugars and nutrients, survived. And so the mycorrhizal fungi then surged. These are fungi that pair up with plants. And then speciation began anew, and fungi inherited the Earth. And then as the skies cleared, we don't know how long, months, years, maybe decades, probably decades, and then we marched forward again until 65 million years ago. And then we had another cataclysmic event. Another giant asteroid hit the Earth and caused the extinction of the dinosaurs. But in between those two periods, 90 million years ago, we have found fossilized amber with perfectly intact mushrooms, caps, gills, and stems, just like you would recognize a mushroom today. And yet, we weren't even little voles 100 million years ago. And this really, you know, we're kind of latecomers on the evolutionary scene, and these fungal ancestors have been here for not only millennia, but millions of years. And I think they are our elders. Biologically, we know that to be true. And with that wisdom and that knowledge going back hundreds of millions of years, there's some information that we can gain from them. And that's what I'm really focused on.
Yeah, and you talk about panspermia also, that life on this planet may in fact have been, some say, seeded by spores traveling through space. It was one of Terence McKenna's, you know, wry observations. He goes, people talk about UFOs. No, no, they're far too literal. If you've ever eaten mushrooms or psilocybe mushrooms, you know, then the aliens are in you, and you're a UFO.
Well, it's on the recent front cover of Scientific American, so it's not just Terence McKenna and Paul Stamets.
Uh-huh.
There's a lot of people that believe in panspermia, and big concern now is we are reseeding Mars. And life may have come from Mars, and there's lots of articles recently talking about the probability of Mars meteorites entering into the Earth's atmosphere within a year of the Mars being impacted by a meteorite. And even though that's improbable, when you have a million fragments, they're one in a million is thought to make that journey in less than a year, and encapsulated deeply within the rock could be these microbes. So I think this is all very, very plausible. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to really follow the logic path here, and it makes sense. You know, I don't think the Earth started 6,000 years ago. I think that's a pretty difficult argument to convince anybody of, unless you're living in a vacuum and not reading. But, you know, we certainly have an enormous amount of knowledge now that we know, in the context of time, we're just a small blip in the theater of both evolution as well as the generation of the cosmos.
Yeah, and you're right. In your introduction, we face the possibility of being rejected by the biosphere as a virulent organism. But if we act as a responsible species, nature will not evict us. So, yeah, I think we want to dive in and our rich nutrient here. Some of the things that I know you have a lot of leading edge. The things that I've quoted of you for years are your incredible slideshow I saw about also mushrooms transforming poison, transforming E. coli, transforming diesel oil spills, this capacity to metabolize poison. And I did say to you some eons back, because a number of listeners had said, what about, you know, depleted uranium? And I think I asked you that, and you said, no, nothing in nature can metabolize uranium. They can collect it, but only for as long as they don't degrade, and then, you know, you're back where you are. But I think you said, but the little guys are working on it. I mean, they are our allies for the innumerable irreverent crises we've created as humans. You are really their agent, as we have solutions, yeah?
Well, yeah, there's a real good example. After Chernobyl, when the Swedish Geiger counters went off, and when Chernobyl outside of Kiev in the Ukraine blew its top, so to speak, a radioactive plume went over Europe. And so, you know, when they were very concerned about downwind contamination, and since the Ukrainians and the Russians have a long history of collecting wild mushrooms, there was great health concerns about how radioactive were these mushrooms. And so mycologists that I know started sampling these over a period of 20 years. Remarkable, remarkable results. There is a mushroom that grows here in California, as well as Washington State, and I'm not sure back in Washington, D.C., but it's called the Hideous Gomphidius. That's its local name. It's Gomphidius glutinosus. It hyperaccumulates cesium-137 10,000 times the background contamination. Now, why in the world would this mushroom hyperaccumulate cesium? And they went around and they found that there are species-specific hyperaccumulating mushrooms that will hyperaccumulate certain metals, radioactive and non-radioactive. And by doing so, it detoxifies the surrounding environment. And as I believe, these fungi take the long-term view of looking at the health of their descendants, as we should, going many of their generations downstream, by hyperaccumulating this toxic metal into one location in a square foot, and detoxifying the surrounding ecosystem, then the plants and the animals and the protozoa and the bacteria and the other fungi thrive. In doing so, plants grow, more debris trails, more biodiversity, the ecosystem begins to recover. There are these hot spots, you know, but the hot spot is the expense that the ecosystem pays for the entire ecosystem to be able to respond and regrow. So I'm fascinated by these species that do these hyperaccumulating properties. Now, we cannot break down heavy metals. All we can do is move them around. And I don't know of any research on uranium, though I am in contact with a few scientists who are exploring that. But there is ostensibly in the future the ability of creating mycelial mats customized to the toxic waste profiles that can hyperaccumulate heavy metals, break down, as we know now, petroleum-based contaminants, break down dioxins, PCBs, PCPs, arsenic-based compounds, etc. So we have enough knowledge now in what we call micro-remediation that we can articulate defense strategies. And what my book is about is how you and your family and in your community, you can engage fungal allies in suites of them, casts of characters that are customized specifically to the nutritional and the medicinal as well as the toxic loads that you have in your environment. We're a reflection of the environment that has given us birth. And so if the environment is polluted, we are polluted. And mushrooms are the very interesting mitigators between the two. And they can do a lot to help us break down these toxic agents that are otherwise be quite harmful.
This is the Visionary Activist Show, and we're going to skip the break because I was told I could do that, and we're just having too much fun, and Paul Stamets, our great guest, has too much to say. But you can join us if you're on theme, if you want to avail yourself of this incredibly valuable medicine man ally knowledge-wise by calling 510-848-4425. And also for a copy of this show, you can go to visionaryactivism.com or 1-888-741-GODS. And let me just say again, too, that Paul Stamets' latest book, Mycelium Running, that just came out 3 weeks ago, you can find it, I hope, in all bookstores and certainly at his website, fungi.com, where you can get immeasurably wonderful, interesting things. I'm not just pitching it. I really believe it. And I give this book, you know, 5 stars. We all need this book. It's a crucial piece of the puzzle. It's part of our dedication on the show. Anybody who's got a piece of the puzzle for, you know, more reverently ingenious culture, and this meets that criterion. So, so let's skip the break and keep going. Because there is so much engaging fungal allies. Again, this idea. So I do tell people. I tell people about your diesel oil spill. It's the oyster mushrooms, yeah, that did that. Is that right?
Yeah, that was in Bellingham, Washington. I was working with Battelle Laboratories, and there was a diesel spill. Actually, it's a 40-year usage of a piece of land where buses and trucks and heavy equipment was parked, and they contaminated the soil. Up to 2% of the soil was actually diesel and oil, and so it was a toxic waste site. And the Department of Ecology put the Department of Transportation on notice that you have a toxic waste site, you have to clean it up. So my research group and I had been doing other experiments, and we had some pretty good ideas. And so there was a trial where there was 4 piles of diesel. These are
Keep going. Yeah, no, don't pay any mind to that.
You know, they're about 30, 40 feet long by 6 feet wide by 5 feet high, about 10 tons of the saturated soil. And we inoculated our one pile of soil with oyster mushroom mycelium. A chemical group came up and used a chemical enzymes. A bacterial group came up and did theirs. The 4th pile was a control pile. 4 weeks later, there was a visit, and samples were taken. And so they came to the 1st pile, the control pile, stinky and dirty and smelly and so oily that you touch this, so you have to use like lava-like soap just to get it off your hands. The second pile, lifeless, dirty, smelly, same thing. 3rd pile, dirty, smelly, same thing. 4th pile, when they took back the tarps, their gasps of astonishment, because there were literally over 1,000 oyster mushrooms, some of them 14 to 16 inches in diameter, which I call them as very happy oyster mushrooms, because they don't get that large unless they have lots of nutrition. And then the soil there, the PAHs, the polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, plummeted from 20,000 parts per million to less than 200. And it did so in a period of 8 weeks. And more excitingly to me was not only it broke down this carcinogenic toxin, which oil is, but the mushrooms were totally edible. They had no petroleum residues whatsoever. And then as the mushrooms, I'm fascinated with how mushrooms rot, because they just don't give up the ghost without predetermining bacterial communities that subsequently grow upon them. That's the lesson of nature. Fungi produce antibiotics preventing bacteria, but then the bacteria want to eat them, and it seemed to me that there was a connection here that's just not random. So what happened in our piles was as the mushrooms sporulated, they attracted insects. Insects came in, laid eggs. Larvae developed. Birds came in after the larvae, presumably, and they brought in seeds. And after 10 weeks, our pile was an oasis of life. Mm. And it became a habitat restoring and thriving, and all these communities and worms were present, and also all sorts of insect communities, and all the other three piles were dead and neutral. So I see these as keystone species. They're called primary saprophytes because they lead downstream in unlocking nutrition that allows other communities to flourish. But in the course of thinking, well, the bacteriologists were going, oh, you know, this is not fair, and, you know, I don't know why they didn't think it wasn't fair, but I said, you know, actually I'm engaging bacteriology. And they go, how? I says, because I'm setting the stage. And as the mushrooms then climax, since they're only there for a while, they give themselves up to bacteria. And then the bacterial communities then start breaking down some of these other more recalcitrant, you know, 6, 7, and 8 ring hydrocarbons, which are much harder to break down, and so the bacterial communities come in. And then the phytoremediation people came on board because I said, well, then the plant communities came. Right. So you start with the primary fungi, and then you go to bacteria, and then you have phytoremediation with plant communities. And this sequence of habitat restoration is described in my book, but this is really what I think is a tremendous template to help guide us into the future. And then in the course of my antibacterial, you know, focus on these mushrooms, mushrooms don't like to rot. They want to sporulate, but then after they do produce these spores, like little seeds, then they soften and they get rotted by bacteria. So I started matching what species of mushrooms resist which bacteria. A group of 8 Merck pharmaceutical employees published a great article, Sway et al. 2000, and where they compared 104 species of mushrooms, and they found that 57 of those had a target-specific antibacterial effect, specifically against Staphylococcus, Streptococcus, or E. coli. And by doing so, you could see that there was actually target specificity, where some mushrooms would resist some bacteria, but then allow other bacteria to grow. That sort of led into, you know, a lot of discussions about anthrax, you know, and these mushrooms resist Bacillus, and Bacillus anthracis is the source of anthrax, the endospore-forming bacterium. And so, make a long story short, basically I got involved with the BioShield program of the U.S. Defense Department that is co-administrated by NIH, U.S. AMRID, U.S. Army Institute, U.S. Army Research Institute of Infectious Diseases, and NIH. And I submitted over 200 samples of my mushrooms grown in vitro. We have 4 laboratories here, 10,000 square feet of clean room. I have about 20 laminar flow hoods. I'm a lab rat. I work in the laboratory all the time. And so I have a very eclectic collection of mushroom strains. So since we knew that my mushroom strains had anti-bacillus properties, we thought, well, it's interesting. The BioShield program is very concerned about viruses. The number one concern of the U.S. government by far is bioterrorism. You can track nuclear weapons and nuclear waste to some degree, but you can't track microbes. They tend to go very quickly and get passed from one individual to another, and they're hard to control. And so it's terrible to found if there was a nuclear explosion in Boston, it would cause billions of dollars for the damage, but it wouldn't stop airplane travel between Seattle and San Francisco. A smallpox epidemic would. And now we are facing potentially a bird flu epidemic. And I wrote this article on the novel antiviral properties of mushrooms about 5 years ago, and that really got some attention and started doing some research, and then I submitted my samples. And 2.5 years ago, we started getting test results back, and now this information's vetted now by the U.S. Defense Department. I'm allowed to talk about it. And I filed multiple patents, which are viewable on the patent homepage. But the striking result that we got is a mushroom called agarikon. It actually is the one that Dioscorides first described as a treatment against consumption, later to be known as tuberculosis. This mushroom is exclusive in the old-growth forests of Washington State, Oregon, and British Columbia.
Uh-huh.
And it is highly effective against pox viruses.
So now, at last, there's a reason for our government to save old-growth forests.
I believe we should save the old-growth forests as a matter of national defense.
Yes.
And this is the tip of the iceberg, is that we have an obligation for future generations that we preserve the genomes from which we will need to derive new medicines and harnessing the power of these organisms. And for us to lose biodiversity and these sensitive habitats is contrary to protecting American people from attack, whether it's natural or man-made. Osama bin Laden does not have an old-growth forest. We do. And this mushroom is now thought to be extinct in Europe. It actually exists in two or three locations that are highly secret, but it still can be found in Washington and Oregon. And we have high activity against orthopoxes, vaccinia and cowpox, and now we just got a result back against smallpox, the variola virus.
And also how that is from people eating it keeps makes them...
The mushroom, this is a very important for me to emphasize. You cannot protect yourself from pox viruses by going out and harvesting this mushroom from the old-growth forest.
Right.
You would destroy the genome in doing so. It's a specialized method that I've developed in growing the mycelium. And we actually took the fruit bodies, the actual mushrooms, and we tested those, and they were inactive. They had no activity against pox viruses at all. But when you take one of these mushrooms and you take a piece of tissue and put it onto a petri dish, it reforms into mycelium, into this web. And then after a long time, an old-growth tree, it reforms into a mushroom. Well, the single threads of mycelium are producing extracellular metabolites. And in the sweat are these antibacterial, antimicrobial, antiviral agents. And so we have now tested six strains of Ommitopsis officinalis. That's a Latin name for this mushroom called agaricon. And all of them are active against orthopoxes. And so now we've broadened our antiviral screens, which I can't get into right now, but the results are extremely interesting and promising. And in the course of this, I became good friends with Gu Zhao, who is the president of the Haida people on the Haida Gwaii Islands. They have a long history of the use of medicinal mushrooms, and much of it is secret. And so I flew up there upon his invitation and spent several days with him in the old-growth forest. And Gu Zhao's population, the Haida, formerly called the Queen Charlotte, they don't like to call it the Queen Charlotte Islands because that was the ship that brought in the smallpox. So they called it the Haida Gwaii, that was their name for it. But he told me they went from 50,000 people to 500 in 4 years because of smallpox. And we have an unfortunate history in this country that we must remember is the United States government and the British government were actively involved in bioterrorism against indigenous peoples. We must not forget this. And Gu Zhao, they used agaricon, Phlomitopsis officinalis, and it was associated with woman shamans who, upon their graves, this mushroom was placed and was carved into the shamanic figure and helped them carry on into the spirit world. And so I told Gu Zhao about my research. I said, your people were devastated by smallpox, and yet this mushroom grows on your island, and you revered it, but the mushroom was inactive. But the tree that was rotting, if you could scoop out that bark, that might have been active. And Gu Zhao told me, if we knew it was active against smallpox, we would have used it because the Christian missionaries, when they came into the Haida Gwaii Islands, if you converted to Christianity, you got a scab. And this is the source of vaccinia or vaccines. And the scab then would help you get an immunological defense. Those of us from European backgrounds, we have a history of raising cattle. So we got exposed to cowpox, and cowpox, then over hundreds of years of exposure, we developed a partial immunity to smallpox. So the pox viruses, if once you're resistant to one, you are resistant to others. Well, the Haida never raised cattle, and many Native Americans never raised cattle, the European tradition. And as a result, they had no history of exposure to cowpox, and so 90% of them died from smallpox infection. And the missionaries used the scabs as a way of showing that Christian medicine was more powerful than Native medicine. And the Native Americans lost their shamans face. They lost the trust of their people, large degree because the European medicines were more powerful. But it was a directed, specifically planned bioterrorist strategy used by the American and British governments because they didn't want to fight these warriors. They were 8-1, according to Gu Zhao, and how many Europeans they could kill. These guys were in the old-growth forest, and they lived and grew up there. They knew how to do guerrilla warfare. So the generals realized, geez, we can just send in some blankets or one person and come back in the spring, and we can walk through these villages.
So the Haida had the antidote unbeknownst to themselves in their midst.
Unbeknownst to themselves, but they've only been there 10,000 years. I mean, again, we have to experiment constantly in nature to find novel medicines. And we're still engaged, and we cannot lose contact with our natural origins because around us is many of the solutions to the problems that we face today.
Exactly. So, but the BioShield department of of the government that you've been working with too, it would be used in what form? I mean, as a protection.
Antiviral.
I know, but you would eat the mycelia.
we basically have made extracts, and we are now, I've now engaged with the National Center for Natural Products Research at the University of Mississippi, which is federally funded and owned. They were the people that grow the legal marijuana and do lots of interesting drug research. And now they are actually a part equity owner in my intellectual property should this become a drug. So now the people of America, you know, the United States government, is now a part owner of my intellectual property, even though a minor owner. And this way, this is important. The only market for this, of course, is the U.S. government, the British government, et cetera, all these other foreign governments, because we do not have a smallpox epidemic today, thankfully, but it still survives. It still survives in India and in China, and we know that Al-Qaeda and other Islamic groups have gotten their hands on some of the smallpox viruses. I've been to Russia a few times. I'm just hoping that the virus has died in their refrigerators because their storage facilities were so bad. But this is something that we face as, you know, smallpox knows no borders. And whether it's bird flu or smallpox or some other virus, SARS, this should be a common theme here, folks, that we are going to have an epidemic because the rule of nature is when an organism exceeds the carrying capacity of its environment, diseases spread.
Right. Yes, and also when we look at, you know, how birds are treated, how swine are treated, how, you know, it makes complete sense that we are breeding these viruses and these epidemics as well. But so do people, you know, in your understanding, take it as part of the general tonic? Is it a preventative, or is it once somebody's contracted something?
These are in vitro tests, and the giant chasm between in vitro and going to human or mammal studies. We are on that path. It is a antimicrobial, preventing as well as treating after the fact. The current vaccination program that the U.S. government has established, at best case scenario, Dr. John Norris is a new partner. He's a former assistant director of the FDA. He's founded the Bioterrorism Institute. We've actually created a new company specifically as a commercial vehicle for developing this type of patented, patented medicine. And he says that the best case scenario is 30% of Americans would be vaccinated, and that means the rest of us would not be, and then 30% of us from European backgrounds will die from smallpox, 30% have become blinded, 30% of us become horribly scarred, and then 10% survive without any symptoms. So, and native peoples, of course, the ratio is quite different. So it would be presented as a preventative as well as a treatment after the fact. Interestingly, in the Defense Department, and I met a lot of conservatives now, who actually are environmentalists in the closet. They didn't like the spotted owl. They couldn't really put their hat on that peg, so to speak. But you talk about bioterrorism, the fact that we have a mushroom in the old growth forest that's on the bridge of extinction, and how important it is for world health as well as protecting the United States population. It's very interesting that people go, oh, now I understand why we should save the old growth forest.
Well, and you even get the spotted owl in there, even though it's not verified, but you mentioned also the crucial function of animals and animal scat in spreading and spreading the mycelia and the spores and the mycelia, that's all part of it too. Even the spotted owl, therefore, is necessary for national defense. Yes?
Well, I wouldn't go so far.
Oh, all right.
But I would never underestimate the complexity of these ecosystems. The spotted owl's main diet is the flying squirrel. The flying squirrel's primary diet are truffles. And so if you lose the truffles, you lose the flying squirrel, and then you lose the spotted owl. However many intricate permutations of those relationships are unknown. But this is really the tip of the iceberg, and if we, you know, to put it in perspective, 1942, a housewife, literally in Peoria, Illinois, sent in a moldy cantaloupe to a U.S. Army hospital in response to the U.S. government's plea to Americans to send in your moldy fruit. From her moldy cantaloupe was derived a strain of Penicillium notatum, also known as Penicillium cryogenum, that it gave rise to a strain that produced 200 times more penicillin than any strain heretofore seen. The Nazis and the Japanese did not have penicillin. The Americans and British did. And the fact that we had penicillin meant battlefield wounds, which were 90% fatal, then became the soldiers survived 90%. So the importance of biodiversity is critical. And this mushroom does not enjoy the widespread range of a cantaloupe. It is localized in an endangered and shrinking ecosystem, and we need to get hundreds of these strains in culture. And we have a method now that we don't even have to take the mushrooms out of the forest. We just take a little tube and take a small piece of its tissue, and we're able to generate a master culture. So I'm dedicated to protecting as many of these endangered strains as possible, because they may prove to be another taxol. And we have great hopes that this could be a new taxol that could have broad antiviral properties. Now, that's a giant leap in logic, but so far, my intuition has been pretty good.
Your intuition is superb, because once again, we put this under the category of, you know, will we find the thing that heals us before we kill it? You know, it's like, oh, humans. Now, we do want to get to many things, termites, non-harm, you know, how mushrooms can help us in many ways. Let's go to our first incredibly succinct caller, Marie Louise in Palo Alto. Come in, succinct.
Well, with that labeling, what am I to do? But anyway, I just want to tell you that once a fantastic man looked at me and asked me what I was doing. When I told him what, he said, if I had a hat on, I would take my hat off for you. And you mentioned hanging the hat up on the hook, Paul, and I just want to tell you, yeah, if I had a hat on, I'd take it off for you, too. But I've been applauding as I've been listening all the time, and I've heard you once before, and I really thank you for this. I am a Swede who picked mushrooms in my early years, and I honor the Aborigine where, you know, the Aboriginal ways. I feel more like, I think, a Native American almost than I feel like a European coming here, but I do know I'm a visitor on this continent. But anyway, I just want to thank you so much for your work and tell you that the mushrooms always call to me. And I am in awe of them, and your work is fantastic. So I'm
well done.
Well, thank you. And what he's really speaking to also is there's a generational passage of knowledge. When you go out with your parents into the woods and you're a small child and you find mushrooms, many elders have told me when they've been in their 80s that their favorite memories are the quiet times they spent with their parents away from the phones, away from the business, in the quiet woods, and it's like a constant Easter egg hunt. And the children are rewarded with the pleasure and the attention of their parents. And this type of traditional, transitional knowledge is something that we need to really get back to is spending quiet time with our children in a natural environment. So, you know, whether you're from Sweden or if you're from South America or if you're Native American, you can carry on your family's tradition. Whether it's a sacred mushroom patch or a secret mushroom patch or a particular way of cooking them, etc. This is something that's a long treasured part of people's family history, and I think it's important.
It is. It's crucial. And you mentioned in book and everywhere that you influence also, too, you know, long used in indigenous medicine. Well, when they found the Iceman, right, the man who was frozen to death in the Alps, you know, he had a little bag of antibiotic mushrooms in his pouch, you know. And also, just as a footnote, too, I was listening to the BBC two nights ago, just the tail end of a story about how they're going into major production in Africa because they found this mushroom that will prevent malaria transmission and reduce it to 96%. And we go, oh, it's happening all over. So, yes. And also, you have your line of mushrooms out. I'm actually happy to buy from my friends in the health food store. I did eat, you know, Mental Clarity before the show. One of your blends. So things are, you're putting things out into availability as well.
Yeah, I'm the worst marketer of my own product.
Oh, we all are.
It's there, and you know, I'm dealing with great people. I really like the people that are helping me. They're really, really high quality, but I'm focused so much on the science and these bigger picture ideas.
Yep.
You know, and it's the commercial vehicle that carries the message forward. So I thank everybody that does support us because, you know, this is a great example of American entrepreneurialism. And George W. Bush and Dick Cheney should be proud that an environmentalist entrepreneur, you know, left-of-center scientist with his own laboratory complex spent $200,000 of his own money to come up with a possible treatment against pox viruses. I have no institutional money behind me. I have no academic money behind me. I've spent money that customers have sent us to buying mushroom kits or our products off the shelves. I've reinvested it into my own research, and I think it will have a big public payoff, because ultimately, it's not what you make in this lifetime, it's how you are remembered and the heritage that you establish. And I think that all of us, as we get older, you can't take your toys with you, but you can leave a history that will be built upon that can save lives. And my wife and I, we literally have the impression that every day that we wake up, there's another day that we can save thousands of lives.
Huh.
Now, maybe I'm exaggerating. Maybe it's 10 lives. Maybe I'm not exaggerating. Maybe it's millions of lives. But somewhere in between there, I have the sense that what we are doing today will have enormous implications downstream. And it ties in science and mysticism and indigenous people's value and view of nature. And I think that we should really take a step back. And we are truly Neanderthals with nuclear weapons. And I think our descendants are screaming back to us through time, saying, wake up, look around you, do you see what you are doing? And the Pat Robertsons and these people who are just throwing up all these smoke screens are really doing a disservice ultimately to the agenda that we should be prioritizing. And so it's such a fun life that I live right now.
No, it's a great and beautiful life, and I think it's part of your 30-year, one full Saturn cycle dedication, you know, devoted to Venus, really, restoration of intimacy, you know, and we track our affinities. You're our mycelia agent guy, too, following our craft with heart and certainly, you know, tracking patterns. I apologize to the inadvertently patient callers waiting, but we just want to pack in a little more information before we go, too, because I was at one meeting also, too, where you were meeting with termite company executives, because you'd found a kind of mushroom that was toxic to termites but nothing else.
Yeah, I have several patents. They're viewable on the patent homepage. They've been approved, and says several are pending. But I have a totally environmentally benign method of getting rid of termites, carpenter ants, and fire ants in people's houses. It's very inexpensive to produce. The mycelium actually is picked up by the workers and given to the queen as sort of an ambrosia food. The queen then passes it around. The insect colony becomes fuzzy with its mycelium. Lots of insects grow mycelium. They just don't know that this one is fatal to them. And then suddenly the entire colony is wiped out, and it prevents future invasions. And so it's an innovative patent. It's been called a paradigm shifting patent. It has the potential of restructuring the chemical pesticide industry from top to bottom. And therein, I think, lies one of its problems. It's too radical. But yeah, I've been awarded a patent for those four insects, and now the patent office is giving me an award for all social insects, any insect using a queen. And it doesn't create a plague across the planet. It's localized specifically to the colony that you want to treat, and it's non-toxic to the water or to other animals or plants.
Pragmatic marvels. We're on our way out. Thank you so much, Paul Stamets. May this be part one, and maybe we can just continue at some point also in the future, too. You can find his book, maybe at all bookstores, but fungi.com. Please go there, absolutely. I want to thank our great psychic board up in Washington, Jonathan Cherry, and Erica Bridgman in Berkeley. I'm Caroline Casey. We will reconvene next week. Happy Thanksgiving. And for a copy of the show, go to visionaryactivism.com or 1-888-741-GODS. Thank you again, Paul Stamets, for your work. Woof, woof, woof.
Thank you, Caroline. And thanks to all the people that I couldn't talk to. So.
Yeah, more later.
Well, all right.